Today, we're discussing information warfare, or disinformation. What can be done to counter, disrupt, or inoculate against the tide of organized information pollution? I'm joined by three experts who have worked across Southeast Asia, South Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. Gemma Mendoza is a journalist based in Manila. Gemma leads Rappler's efforts to address disinformation, focusing on digital media, harnessing big data research, fact-checking, and community workshops.
We saw the shift online from 2016 and moving forward. You saw the shift from happy to anger. There was a marked difference in the language and so on. And that's something that data scientists have also noted.
Nicola Matheson is research director at the Global Network on Extremism and Technology at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization.
Over the past few years, there's been an increase in programs and tactics on how to address disinformation online. The problem is, we don't really know how well it works.
Yasser Khan is editor-in-chief at the Thomson Reuters Foundation. He's a veteran journalist with extensive international experience and has pioneered many digital news solutions and innovations.
The trouble is, it's very easy to create disinformation and misinformation. Good information and journalism is hard and expensive to make. So we have a devil of a time keeping up with the volume.
You're listening to the Oslo Governance Center Preventing Violent Extremism podcast. I'm Annalise McAuliffe.
Gemma, I'd like to ask you first, just how much power do these social media companies have?
In the past, traditional media like radio, for instance, and television would be the one that have greater reach. But more and more, and particularly during the pandemic, digital media became the source of information of people. But what's significant is the depth of involvement or immersion in digital compared to other traditional media. In the Philippines, we've been the social media capital for years now, so many years. And that level of immersion is in effect resulting in essentially digital and particularly social media being the factor that determines where conversations, where political conversations go, and it's swaying public opinion. And that information ecosystem essentially promotes narratives that have been proven and debunked so many times by experts, by journalists, and so on.
And Gemma, there was a recent piece of research that I think Rappler was involved in. Is it the Pulse Asia?
Yeah, so one thing that came out in the Pulse Asia survey is that people recognize this information, and the source of this information, they say, are the vloggers, the social media influencers. But at the same time, what was really noteworthy there, number two, are the journalists. So the newsrooms, we are the second source, supposedly, of this information. And it's very concerning for how people perceive fact-based reporting as well. So it shows the polarization, the political polarization, as well as the amount of disinformation that has been part of attacks against mainstream news groups. And in fact, one thing that is significant there is the top two newsrooms in the country, ABS-CBN and Rappler, were among the ones that are least trusted.
You know a little bit about reach. Tell us a little bit about now how you've taken perhaps some of that knowledge and looked at now the information infrastructure and how it can be manipulated as well.
One of the key things here is the history of mainstream media organizations, right? Historically, how did mainstream media organizations come about telling people the news? Every morning, a bunch of people sat in a room and decided what was important enough to tell the world, having no idea whether or not people who were reading them or listening to them wanted to know that or if they wanted to know something else. So we were the purveyors of important information. And as such, you know, I think a lot of, I don't know how it was in the Philippines, but I know that, you know, in the West, we made ourselves these special people as opposed to participants in the community or in communities that we are covering. I remember when I was working at the CBC in Canada, standing up in the newsroom and asking, when was the last time any of you met a working class journalist? You know, we go into working class neighborhoods, we report on them, we come back, we do the report, and then we go home to our middle class homes and we go to sleep. Well, those chickens have come home to roost now, right? Where everybody's an information purveyor. Nobody needs to wait for us to tell them the news. The news happens and people talk about them on Twitter and other social platforms, and then they, you know, derive their own meanings. And the algorithms, the way they work is they create echo chambers for you. And I think legacy media organizations are still so used to getting into a room and deciding to tell the world what's important that they're completely caught on the back foot when it comes to how to deal with echo chambers. The constant question is, we keep telling people the right information, but why aren't they listening to us? Well, because perhaps you're not serving or you're not validating certain people's, you know, sentiments. I think the way we are dealing with it now as a news organization, and remember the Thomson Reuters Foundation is also a legacy news organization where what we did every day was we decided what to tell the world and then we did the stories and they all went out on the newswire and we thought we were done with it. With digital platforms, you know, hitting publish on a story, we are now learning, is not the end of a process, but the beginning of a process. Your story's life begins as soon as you hit publish, as opposed to you've done your job, you now move on to the next story. As part of our editorial process, what we have is an audience development team that looks at what trends are out there. What are our, first of all, we needed to figure out who our audience is and what do they expect from us? And what are they reading and what are they not reading? And that goes into decision-making for every story that we cover. The second thing is we look at what is our audience talking about and what are our audience members not talking about and where can we add to the conversation in a meaningful way. We monitor the feedback from the story. You know, what are people talking about? What are they not talking about? What are they connecting with? What are they not connecting with? And I think this is a slow process, right? We're nowhere near where we want to be. But what we're finding is that when we pay attention to our audiences and our readership, we get a lot less trolling and we get a lot more feedback. This should be a governmental responsibility, right? All of the disinformation.
You mean to counter this?
Well, look, people doing the trolling and the online abuse and spreading the disinformation are citizens. People who are victims of that are also citizens. Nobody's asking governments the accountability question about why are private companies involved in protecting citizens from online harm, including disinformation? Why aren't you involved? And if you are involved, to what extent are you involved in this?
I think this is a good place to bring Nicola in, because Nicola, you know, the big tech companies really have monetized this sort of harvesting of data and attention for and. So what is their responsibility, do you think, and how much can they really control this? I mean, what's the solution here? Is there a solution?
Big questions, very big questions. Bad actors are getting increasingly sophisticated, presenting themselves as real sources of information. So it's not just a case of finding the bad actors, it's also about addressing the flow-on effect of that. And in terms of what you can do, over the past few years, there's been an increase in programs and tactics on how to address disinformation online. The problem is we don't really know how well it works. So some of the main ones, fact checking and enabling users to see that there might be information within this post that is not factually correct. Now, the issue with this is while it might be effective and it might discourage people from clicking on that information, there's just such an overwhelming amount of content online that has to be managed. And at the end of the day, disinformation is not necessarily a tech problem, it's a social problem. And so at every point, as much as tech companies are responsible in many ways for ensuring harmful content is not online and on their websites or on their platforms, it is the individuals who are creating the content who are responsible. And I think this really speaks to Yas's point about the kind of findings about why people are so engaged with disinformation. Is there's not that trust in news sources anymore. And what, I mean, in our case, extremists, but I think any other alternate viewpoints that are being put forward, what they're getting really good at is a tactic called fogging or flooding. So you either introduce multiple alternative narratives to introduce doubt within the audience as to what is real, and introducing the idea that maybe the government is not telling the truth. And we can see historically, we know the government doesn't always tell the truth. So that's like a really real world, easy example of where you can find that hook. And then flooding is when you introduce a very specific narrative and flood the social media platforms with it.
Lots of things I want to pick up on there later. I'll let Gemma hop in. She's got a comment she wants to make. Gemma, over to you.
In the Philippines, we've really established that there are actors that are aligned with state, aligned with political leadership. And it's well documented. We've seen, we've done quite a lot of research on that, even documented, which are these accounts. And what we have actually seen is a steady growth, and it happened even after elections. So like from 2016, you would have seen, you have thought that hyper-partisanship or partisanship in general, because it's after the elections, would die down. But what actually happened was that it ramped up further, and it seemed to go with the increase in resources available to parties concerned, to parties that are benefiting from the disinformation. We've seen and we've documented clear cases of narratives that are purposely seeded against mainstream media. So this is not a question of, and yes, we understand that the newsrooms need to be more attuned to their audiences. In fact, we grew from that. Raptors started digital and listening. We are into social sensing. And that part of that workflow was really part of the DNA of Raptor. And how we shifted was basically because we saw the shift online from 2016, from happy to anger. It really, there was a marked difference in the language and so on. And that's something that data scientists we've worked with have also noted. So there's that. There's the question of narratives that are being seeded. There are questions of attacks against newsrooms. So this is not just a question of misinformation that is, you know, accidentally shared. There is a purpose to the disinformation.
Okay, I would like to get some more views, I think maybe going to Yasa now, about fact-checking. Is there a way forward? Has anyone seen a really good fact-checking model? Yasa, to you first.
No, that's the short answer. Because look, algorithms on especially social platforms, they favor engagement over expertise, right? And you have seen this example many, many times in your own sort of, on your own platforms, on your own accounts, where the disinformation post gets mounds more, piles of more engagement than the fact check does. And honestly, if I knew how to get around that, I would not be working here. I'd be a millionaire. That is something that we grapple with every day. And I don't think anybody has come up with the solution. And, you know, to expect social media platforms to be the arbiters of you know, fact-checking and the truth is folly, because that's not what they're in this business for. They're in this business to keep eyeballs on their platform.
Nicola, over to you. Fact-checking, what's your experience been? Have you seen better models, models that work in some contexts?
I would say one of the risks of fact-checking within extremist narratives, and even just if we don't yet class them far right, if we just have conservative or conspiracy narratives, fact-checking plays into that narrative. What's really compelling about, I mean, first of all, the beauty of radicalization is you don't know what's happened to you. But it also means you're given these counter-narratives built into the conspiracy or the ideology. So when a state comes forward with fact-checking information or information about, for example, COVID is a really good example, the counter-narrative has already been built in, that the state is lying to you. Of course, this is what they're going to say. They're going to say you're extremist. They're going to say you're stupid and unintelligent and not following the science. I mean, there are other strategies that are used. So there's friction. So you increase the number of clicks that it takes in order to reshare information. The issue with that is you also increase the number of clicks to share good information or factual information. And there's also media literacy is one that's talked about all the time. And we're in an age where there is a huge blurring between online and offline life. It no longer exists. And so we can increase media literacy from a really young age, but that increases skepticism towards news sources and disinformation and factual information. So you're increasing skepticism towards both. And so it's really important in those spaces to, when trying to implement them, understand that there is the risk of doing both. So how do you counter that? And I haven't seen a good explanation as to how you do both. But also knowing that media literacy, again, when taken by alternative narratives and people who participate in active disinformation, they use all of the terms of media literacy to sell their story. So it's, again, both sides are using it, much like in social media spaces. Many are using it for good, to share factual information and to assist, at the same time as bad actors are using it to manipulate. And so can you ever get rid of one or shift the balance between them?
Yes, a very quick comment, follow-up from you, and then Jim.
The trouble is, it's very easy to create disinformation and misinformation. Good information and journalism is hard and expensive to make. So we have a devil of a time keeping up with the volume, right? And also countering things and fact-checking has become such a full-time job. And it is very, very far from having the effect we would like it to have. You know, my parents, for instance, big spreaders of misinformation. And I constantly tell them, you know, you are a parent, you've given birth to a journalist and you can't do this. And they do it on WhatsApp. In India, WhatsApp is huge in terms of spreading misinformation. You can't monitor that. They call it WhatsApp University in India, where anybody becomes an expert within two WhatsApp posts. And, you know, I've created a rule for my mom, and which is, if something says at the top, forwarded many times, don't forward it. It still kept happening. And I had to use a religious argument for her because she is very religious. And I said, do you know it's a sin to spread lies? And that's when the WhatsApp University stopped in my WhatsApp feed on our family group. But the thing is, there are so many people like my mom who is a very smart person. She is the only one among her siblings to have a master's degree and the first woman in her entire family to have a master's degree. So she is not an idiot. But, you know, they're from a generation where when something is printed well and looks nice, it must be true, right?
Gemma, over to you. Lots to pick up on there.
Yeah. So first of all, we're a third party fact check partner of Facebook. We're a verified signatory of the Code of Ethics of IFCN. And that means we do fact check on Facebook and on other social media. But I agree that it's not enough. And what we have been doing over the past years, essentially, is like looking at the different other things that need to happen on, alongside fact checking. So one of the things that is very critical is making sure that personal data, the use of personal data, because really what's happening with these platforms, and there's quite a lot of studies around that already, the use of personal data is what's making everything hypercharged. Essentially, the persuasiveness, the level of persuasion is really more effective because it is tailored to you. And the more tailored it is to you, the more you are persuaded and you're brought into these echo chambers and these hyper-partisan groups. So you start, for instance, with QAnon and all those other health misinformation, and then later you are like driven into other channels that are like somehow related and or are also operated by the same personalities and the same actors. So in relation to the platforms, and there really needs to be serious moderation, like enforcement of moderation, of community moderation standards. We're talking here of actors, not just the content. And one of the biggest disappointments is really when you're exempting leaders from fact-checking, when in fact, they are the ones who are most persuasive. They have followings. And when you're exempting them and you're allowing them to lie, that means you have followers out there who will believe the lies. So that's really a significant thing. Now, what we did is, it's a work in progress. It's something that we're hoping will take off during the elections. It kind of got a lot of traction. It's a collaboration that is multi-level and multi-sectoral. The first layer there is fact-checking the different news groups participating in the fact-check efforts. But because Yasir said, fact checks are really boring. That's the reality.
That's not the word I used. I didn't think
no, boring. I am saying that fact checks are really boring. News also is boring. I covered the national budget before I did this information research, and all my stories are hardly read, even if they're important and important to the taxpayer. So it's really that's a reality we face. Whereas, you know, rumors, fantasies, novel, they're one, easy to create, no need to fact check, no need to verify. And they're novel, they're very interesting. They tickle the fancy of people. So that's really the problem. So what we tried to do is work with different communities, civil society groups, even church groups, because they're all over the country. Like helping them understand the methods, at the very least, understand the methodologies behind fact-checking. What we're trying to do is a mesh network, because what we realized from the research is that all this disinformation, apart from being very novel, they were actually the actors that are seeding them. They are working in networks. They're amplifying each other. And that is great for the algorithm. That's why that is getting a lot of traction. So we need a counter mesh. And that's what we're trying to do right now in the Philippines. What we are trying to do here is to have that layer where you have communities sharing the different newsrooms, but also the newsrooms themselves sharing each other's content. That's something that we are trying to do in the Philippines. We've started that with fact checks and related content. And having that mesh around, like that sharing action, like count, like engagement, that repeated engagement, essentially, ideally, the thinking there is that that will give that content that you're pushing a higher reach in social media. And we've seen that happen in the elections, like because of these mesh networks, the reach of fact checks increased as compared to previous elections when we were just fact checking and no community action ongoing.
So fact checking, essential because we still need to hold these people to account, but we're still struggling to find really viable models of how to do it. And perhaps even if it's not read widely, it's still important that we do it. So I want to move on now a little bit to resilience. We can't get rid of disinformation. We can approach it and tackle it in different ways. But how do we then deal with the fact that everything we do is impacted by disinformation and people really need to become resilient to it and understand it better so that they can acknowledge it and perhaps kind of like nod to it and move on? Nicola, can you take that one on?
I think Gemma hit the nail on the head with resiliency. It is a multifaceted community level approach. And we know that when it comes to any number of programs that include the sharing of alternate worldviews that are damaging. So if it was mobilization and radicalization, removing passports, sure, is one thing, but it's really those everyday interactions with community members and within your own networks that is the most impactful. And so I think it's those really micro efforts in conjunction with these ream of other measures, but it's really those local interactions that make you more resilient and make sure you're not operating in the isolation of the online space. So maybe you've had a conversation as a family about disinformation and you have someone that you can talk to something you come across about. But at the moment, we did a survey of 7,000 people about their interactions with extremism online. And the majority of people thought it was the social media company's responsibility to combat hate speech and extremism online. And that completely removes the social aspect of it. That's only responding to a problem. So I think the resiliency really comes from preferably an offline space.
Okay. And Yasa, over to you with a slight twist to the question. Resilience to disinformation, what role does the independent media play and how can we foster more independent media to provide better information?
I always feel encouraged when the trolls go after a fact checker because you then know that they're doing something right. You know, I always wonder why mainstream media organizations compete on the internet, because there's 3 billion people on the internet. All you need is 100 million and everybody else can have the rest. And there's enough to go around. And so this whole competition business is an anchor that holds media organizations behind because it really kills collaboration, especially with smaller outfits. So yeah, the more we wake up and smell the internet and foster cultures of collaboration across with indies who are doing good work, the better, and solidify their funding models and their revenue models.
And Gemma, I see you nodding along to that because Rappler certainly has had that experience of the trolls attacking the independent media. I mean, you're the poster children of that movement. So tell us how you deal with that. I mean, and you know, we sort of laugh, but we also realize it's an incredibly serious problem, not only in the Philippines, it's a global issue about almost like the better the journalists do their jobs, the more they're going to be attacked, and protection of journalists has become such a serious issue. So how does Rappler take that on?
With the trolling, really, the trolling took a toll on the newsroom. Definitely the one thing that we had to do was like make sure that our reporters, our social media personnel, the ones who are always looking at the trolls, the comments on social media, they have access to counseling and so on. And then after that, that's really the birth of the research. We started doing the research on disinformation precisely because we wanted to make sense of everything. It's like the investigative reporter in you just kicks in and like, okay, what's happening and what's behind this? So that's in a way one of the interventions that we did. And then finally, the thing that we did is we shared that information with the community of journalists here. And that's helping really in addressing like common problems, because it's not just about the trolling. Like during the elections, we were heavily DDoSed. There were smaller newsrooms that had little reserves and they needed help. So those are the things that the collaboration addressed. And then the other thing is a support system, really. So that's why we have lawyer partners. It's the accountability layer, which consists of volunteer lawyers who are helping not just journalists who have been sued for libel or whatever, but also form cases that will address the attacks, like the harassment. So again, we love multidisciplinary efforts. And it's around that it's different layers of initiatives.
Okay, so we're seeing again, you know, the online world jumping into the offline world with attacks, you know, online and physical on journalists. So that kind of leads us back almost full circle. I mean, are we trying to fix here social and political problems essentially with code? I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think when we say that the online is now offline, that also means that technology is a part of our social world. It's not devoid of it. In saying that it's a social and political problem and not just a tech problem, tech is responding, that doesn't mean they're not all existing in the same ecosystem. And I think there is a willingness in tech companies from our perspective with GIFCT to address these issues. And I mean, there are some things that they're getting very good at with code. They're very good at identifying extremist and terrorist content. And of course, extremist groups are always trying to find ways around that, but they're getting really good at collaborating together. There's something called a hash program at GIFCT where they identify sources of content and share it between platforms to ensure that it's not being spread. And they also have incident protocols in response to shootings and the sharing of manifestos to make sure they get taken off offline really quickly. And those are the easy ones, right? When it's real world violence that we see in real world extremism and we have a word like terrorism that we can attach to it, that makes content moderation, I wouldn't call it easy, but it's tangible. We know what it looks like. And I think in the disinformation space, that's a lot harder, but very interlinked.
Could I just, because we've got like 3 minutes left, yeah. If I can just quickly go to Yasser and then Gemma.
Well, look, to Nicola's point, tech is not something that exists separate from social and political and cultural anymore. It is intertwined with literally every decision we make. Code is in everything, from your fridge to your phone to your payroll to, you know, getting a plumber to fix your shower. It's all code. So I think extricating that and treating it as separate from social and cultural, I think, is a bad idea. I think to both Gemma's and Nicola's points, where, you know, there's no one approach to this. And I think that we will be fighting disinformation for a very, very long time, but we will be fighting it, if we're smart, from many different directions. From the educational perspective, from the public health perspective that we just discovered during COVID, from a national security perspective, from a finance and business perspective, I think there's multiple layers of this. The people who create these problems have it very, very easy. It's easy to create these problems, but in order to fix ourselves and our societies, it's going to take us a long time, and it's going to take us, we cannot afford to ignore any of these angles.
Gemma, final thoughts from you?
The thing that's very hard to ignore, and I really agree with Nicola and Yasir, the thing that's very hard to ignore about tech is scale. So like anything that's on tech, you know, if I circulate this information within my community, that stays with my community. But tech has basically increased the reach, not just within communities in the Philippines, but all over the world. That is the reason why you cannot remove tech from the solution. The other solutions like legislation and so on, and even education, those are the medium and long-term gains. And that will take a bit time. That's what I agree with Yasser. We will be fighting this for quite a long time. But if the tech companies are involved and they just do what they need to do. And if we address things like surveillance capitalism, that is really going to really help a lot.
Okay, well, look, thank you, everybody.
You've been listening to the Oslo Governance Centre's Preventing Violent Extremism podcast. Many thanks to Gemma Mendoza, Yasser Khan and Nicola Matheson for joining me today. If this is your first time joining us, then thanks for listening. The Oslo Governance Centre is part of the United Nations Development Programme's Governance and Peacebuilding Cluster. You can follow the work of the OGC on UNDP's Twitter, Facebook, YouTube and Instagram pages, or on the Oslo Governance Centre's website.